Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to fling your favorite fishing rod around. And here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance covers your boat and your belongings. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to high-five someone. But not while you're holding your fishing rod. That's a prized possession. So hold on tight with both hands and keep it covered through boat insurance. Get more with GEICO.
Hi, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is Mad Yourself a Man. A madman podcast where Vince Mancini and I forget every single word of the podcast title and talk about it.
I got yourself, right?
You did.
I did, yeah.
Thank you all so much for joining us out in podcast land. If you're in podcast land and you're looking to give something some stars that you have just left over in your wallet, please go ahead and give us five of them and a review on the podcast stores where this is applicable. We love reading reviews. We got one recently that... it wasn't a good one, but they gave us five stars, and I have it for us right here.
It's a horrible thing.
They thought it was a horrible thing, and I am basically doing Ira Glass's bit, and I don't care. I don't fucking care, because he's usually doing that bit to a guy named Matt Lieb, right? Am I crazy?
No, it's I know this one. It's our supervising producer. It's not Meeky Meek.
Isn't it like Matt Lieberman or some shit? Matt Lieber? I swear he used to do this too.
It could be.
You know what? Doesn't matter. Point is, It's a horrible thing, this podcast. And today we're going to be talking about from season two of Mad Men, episode two, Flight One. And we have a very special guest today. He is a returning Pod Yourself champion. He is the co-host of Round Ball Rock, which is a basketball podcast. He also has a amazing stand-up comedy album out right now called America's Uncle Dad. Ladies and gentlemen, everyone else, welcome Sean Keane.
Hello. Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure just to be considered. I know you guys rejected a much more loyal podcast guest who had been with them for you a long time.
That's right.
Promised to help them grow, but you had a shot. You have a shot at Sean Keane.
That's right.
That's
everybody
what
else
in the business for.
Gets you, dropped
you
like a plane
it.
Over the Jamaica Bay.
That's right. Right over Jamaica. Yeah, man. We dropping planes, man.
Adrian Brody's on the podcast.
Hey, Wagwan, kill the butty boy. I rewatched that, by the way. Have you guys rewatched the thing where he pretends to be Jamaican just to introduce Sean Paul?
I watch about every 2 weeks.
I only remembered the small clip, and I was like, oh, yeah, he just did an accent because of the wig, but then we realized it goes on.
It's
for
so long.
It's really long.
It's so long.
There was some story ahead of the Oscars where he talked about how he hadn't formally been blackballed from. And people said he got banned from SNL for that, which he has. They just don't.
They don't say it. They don't give you a letter
list. It's one guy that makes the one guy anyway. And his take on it was, yeah, I was workshopping that, and everyone in the cast said I probably shouldn't do it.
The weird thing about it is I was watching it and it was like I got the feeling when I rewatched it that some people had helped him with it. There was
a wig involved.
Yeah.
Lying around.
Yeah. And I was there had to be one guy on the writer's staff who was like, no, do it. It'll crush. Or they were like, do it, it'll crush. And then when he walked away, he said, guys, check this out. I'm about to ruin this guy.
Yeah. This is going to make a great
meme. It was an 11-year-old Shane Gillis. It was like, do it.
Do it.
Bobby Hacker pointed out, and we didn't touch on this, and it sort of slipped my mind as I was writing about the Oscars, but the first part of his insane acceptance speech is him giving the gum that was in his mouth to his wife.
Oh, yeah.
Which
that's right.
is such a low-key, weird move. And Bobby just keeps texting me different pictures of Adrian Brody with the caption, hold my gum.
Hold my gum, yeah.
Here, Harvey Weinstein's ex-wife and the mother of his children. Hold my gum.
Is that who he's with? Is that his wife?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He's raising Harvey's children.
Oh, my God. Yeah, this is...
They wanted to expose him to the culture of the Caribbean. So
yeah, I suppose
is that problematic or is that an actual good guy move
to have the
he's the dad who stepped up?
Oh, I thought you meant
true. Yeah,
I thought
yeah,
you
yeah.
meant the gum thing. I was like, because the gum thing feels very problematic.
Yeah, oh no, that's really low key weird. Like mm-hmm. it's casually like it's casual. It's so casual, but then at the same time, just the weirdest thing to do.
Also, can I just say something?
Yeah, please.
Swallowing gum is totally fine.
Yes.
Yeah. Just, nothing
like,
happens.
You don't need to be weird about it. Just like just swallow the gum. It doesn't actually sit in your stomach for years.
No one wants to hold your gum. Like put it under the seat. Who cares?
Tiny,
it's like the
considering the stuff you generally put in your body, like it'll just absorb some microplastics. Swallow your gum.
Also, like, was he gonna have it later? You know,
yeah, that's the other thing. Like, are you gonna come back and be like, "Hey, babe, you got that gum for me?"
Or it's street going.
Yeah, I said, "Hold my gum." What the fuck? Yeah, you know what? It's like the girl who turned into a blueberry and fucking Willy Wonka the Chocolate Factory. You're like, she wants to have the world record or something.
Yeah,
it's like I don't know, expecting people to do things for you at a really like depraved level kind of thing.
I would divorce
it's
him.
Like the Rock with his piss bottle where he's like, hey, can you do something with this? And it's like, bro, you do something with it. Like, what's wrong with you?
I'm the Rock.
I'll say that Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, that's like a real, that must be something that really bothered Roald Dahl, because all the other kids are like addicted to screens, gluttons,
yeah, right,
selfish, and then he's like, this girl
likes gum.
Chews gum.
Yeah, you know,
mine
I got
is
that is very, that's very of its time. In fact, a few episodes from now, there will be a small gum thing that happens at the office of Sterling Cooper, in which a model gets fired for putting gum on the floor, but it was really Sally. And like Cooper's response to it is like, hey, you cow chewing your cud, get out of here. And it's just like, it's very funny. But Sean Keane.
He's having a stroke.
Sorry, that's me. You know, just I'm Peter Quarterback. I'm the host of the Daily.
You're high when you do a segue. Everybody.
Yeah. But Sean, what's your favorite advertisement?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, I like to spring it on people.
I mean, I guess the one I really liked in my formative teenage years was the Volkswagen commercial where they had that Da 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 song.
Oh, yeah.
Two men like picking up a couch.
Yep. Yeah.
And only later did I realize they were supposed to be gay.
Oh,
so I was just kind of like, this is such a weird commercial. And
interesting.
And then later in life, I did drive a Volkswagen.
We made a parody of this exact video in my video production class.
I'm watching it right now. Let me just fast forward. I'm just trying to see them have sex. And then they finally get there and they look at each other. Oh, I see. They look at each other.
There are passengers and there are drivers.
Are those guys gay?
I guess maybe. I don't know.
Which
I
of
mean,
them is
I
the passenger and which is the driver?
The black guy is the passenger. The white guy is the driver.
Do you think he's like a power passenger though?
Could be. You never really know. Just because you're driving doesn't mean
bucket
you're topping.
Seats.
In the gay community, there are Jettas and there are Passats, and you better figure that out.
Yeah. Oh, it's like Jettas, but the Jets, you know?
Yeah. Other than that, print ads, copper tone, I just love seeing a little girl's bare ass.
Yeah,
but,
you know,
I'd call me crazy.
Yeah, or like whatever other word you want to use. Yeah, no, that those copper tone, like that copper tone girl with the her butt showing, I always thought as a kid, I was always just like, this is egregious.
They
I don't
put
want
it on the bottles too.
Yeah,
put it on the ads. It was like,
yeah, it's weird. It feels like, you know,
and it's not a baby either. It's a little girl.
It's like a 5 year old, yeah. And it's like, listen, am I supposed to be laughing at this girl? What am I supposed to be feeling other
You're
than
supposed to
bad
see that
for
her skin is copper toned, in contrast with the part that's been covered by her underwear up until now, and you see the difference. She's not showing her tan line on purpose. A dog did it.
wait, did a dog
not
do
a
it?
Whore. The dog just wants her.
The dog is a little pervert.
I think also part of the implication was that sunscreen was for children, because like if you're an adult, you just tan, you lay out, you bake, and that's good for you. Whereas if you're a little kid, it's like, oh, this is for parents to put on their children. So,
and once you turn 12, it's canola oil only.
Yeah, that's right. Beach, Speaking of like that, I'm kind of like fucking over the Morton Salt girl. You know that bitch would just be
get out of the rain, stupid.
Get out of the rain, first of all. Second of all, you're literally spilling all of the salt. You fucking idiot. I'm just sick of her bullshit. Come home every day. Ooh, the salt's gone. Ha ha, very funny. Now you got to go back and get more salt. I hope it's not raining. But this isn't a podcast. This isn't a podcast. No, this is a TV show where we talk about podcasts. And we, of course, cannot start the podcast without first playing the theme song.
Mad yourself, man. Mama always said you'd be there. Chose a madman. Drunk. New advertising. Podcast. Blue moon in your eyes. Mad man. Mad man. Mad man.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, everyone else, once again today we're going to be talking about from season 2 of Mad Men, episode 2, flight 1. Vince, can you break us off a little piece of that synopsis?
I sure can. A plane crash causes the firm to go after the account for the airline involved and drop the smaller airline they have an account with. Peggy pays a visit to her mother and sister, who are now guardians of a child.
That is exactly what had happened. But Vince, Vince, what is happening at the time that this episode was supposed to be set in?
That's right, Matt. We cannot evaluate a period piece divorced from its cultural context. We got to put some of that context back in, and we like to do that with a little something we call the news machine.
I wipe my ass with the Wall Street Journal.
There is no big lie. There is no system. The universe is indifferent.
Well, that's news, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's right. Today, we are going all the way back to August 3rd, 1962, which is August 3rd is when this show aired. In 1962 is when it said this episode in particular.
People get
is
that.
Actually,
people get that by now, right?
Yeah. But this episode is actually set on a very specific day because it references like a specific plane crash. But I didn't do that day. I wanted to keep it with the theme.
Yes,
that
thank you for keeping
back
it consistent.
To the year and not the exact day when this is set. So we're going to August 3rd, 1962.
When did the plane crash happen, though?
It was in February of that year.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't have the date. I was just looking for that a second ago. But I'll tell you what was going on August 3rd, 1962. Thalidomide, I think they just figured out that thalidomide was bad for you, because there's lots more stories about thalidomide and what you're going to do if you've taken Thalidomide, that was like a, it was like a drug that was supposed to help you sleep if when you were an expecting mother, because, you know, both had pregnant wives. They don't sleep a lot.
Yeah. And, I mean,
babies are always in there kicking.
Yeah. I mean, so thalidomide, that's the thing that made the babies into little monsters, right?
Jesus Christ.
No, what?
There's people that have those.
Wait, do they grow up?
Yeah, they have short arms.
Oh, I thought they like were born without skin or something.
No. Well, I don't know. The one that I know about is the where you have like the little misshapen arms.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. All right. Well, so I didn't know that. I thought it was like the birth defects were such that the baby would die. So you're telling me there's like alive people with thalidomide problems?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
If you're having thalidomide problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a little tiny arms ain't one.
Thalidomide ain't one. Other news. None of those stories are like interesting in their own right. So, but I felt like I needed to contextualize.
You just wanted to have a little section where I could say the most cancelable shit I've ever seen.
That's right.
Thalidomide does make the Billy Joel song, We Didn't Start the Fire.
Oh,
yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Thalidomide.
That's in there, huh?
Other news. Reds report U.S. soldier asks asylum. Vienna. Communist broadcast reported Thursday that a U.S. soldier serving with a missile unit in West Germany has asked for political asylum in Czechoslovakia, charging racial discrimination in the U.S. Army.
Oh, shit.
U.S. officials
said
that's like
a pretty good reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when you're reading the story, I was like, oh, it's just some, you know, guy who's like, I'm a secret communist and, you know, I just want to get out of the United States. I'm going to defect. But instead, it's a guy with a very legitimate grievance for 1963 United States, where he's just like, hi, I'm black in America. This sucks.
Yeah. U.S. officials said the soldier vanished May 8th, the day he was to be court-martialed, and that he had no access to secrets in his job as a mechanic. He was identified as Corporal Raymond S. Harold of East Province, Rhode Island. Mm. He last was seen in the West May 30th when he disappeared over the Austrian-Czech border with a German woman.
Nice.
Had her mother defend son. In East Providence, Harold's mother, Miss Lydia J. Harold, said, "It's all a mistake. My son had nothing against his country." She disclosed her son is married to a Japanese woman and has two sons, one of whom is hospitalized with blood disease. She said he never expressed any communist sympathies to her or his wife, Hatsuko, and was a career soldier who wanted to be the whole U.S. to be the army. He loved the army so much.
Man, you know what's so crazy about all that is, like, if you reversed it and it was about a, you know, Soviet soldier who, like, defected, I would expect the mother to say literally the exact same thing. I'm starting to think, call me crazy, that maybe everything we were told about the Soviet Union also applies to the United States.
Oh, wow. Bold. I don't know. Are you sure you want to? Are we recording?
Oh, sorry for being a leftoid libtard, but.
We're going to go to the Los Angeles Times now for this headline. Boy in blockade shot, semicolon, man held.
Boy
in blockade.
Yeah, boy shot, man held.
Mm-hmm.
Lovingly.
Love it.
He ran out of space.
Yeah, he was being
cradled as he watched a boy die.
He was a good man, so I cradled him. The boy has almost nothing to do with it.
Just separate things that just were happening very near each other, but unrelated causes.
James E. Burton, 56, of Bloomington, was held for questioning Thursday after a youth was shot during a dispute on a street blockaded for a drag race.
Mm.
Ronald R. Ellis, 17, of Fontana, was shot in the right shoulder after he and several other teenagers had blocked off a street on which they planned to race cars.
Oh,
Burton
shit.
Told the police the youths refused to allow him and his wife to pass through the street in their car. He said he took his wife home and returned to the scene, demanding passage. He said when several boys threatened him with bicycle chains, he fired three shots at the tires of their parked cars. Burton said at least four of the youths followed him when he returned to his home again and again threatened him with bicycle chains. He told Sheriff's Lieutenant Larry D. Wallace that he then fired one shot, but did not know whether he hit anyone.
I think he hit somebody.
Yeah, Burton was booked at the San Bernardino County Jail, and Ellis was treated for a .38 caliber bullet wound in his shoulder and released.
Damn, it's a pretty big bullet. Okay, so, I mean, I kind of get it. I kind of get it.
Don't block off the street, dude.
Somebody with a bicycle chain, even though it's a bicycle chain. I mean,
well, here's the problem, is he tried to get through, and then they threatened him with a bicycle chain, and then he went home and got his gun and came back.
Yeah, see, yeah.
Shot him. He got through, and then they followed him to his house. Yeah, it was a lot. Yeah.
Okay, so he's also at fault for sure, but, you know, still.
I like that he took his wife home, and he was probably the whole time talking about, I'm going to get my gun, and we're going to go through here, and she said, please take me home.
Yeah, yeah, and then he was like, no, don't worry about it.
I'm going back.
Our reservation is still good.
I'm going to dinner without you.
Yeah, yeah, I don't even need you. First, I just want to brandish my gun at some drag racers, okay? That's it. And then we're going to be on time for the Sizzler. It's still happy hour. We're still going to get half off drinks. Yeah. Why do you have to be such a bitch about it?
All right. We
also,
got
drag was corrupting children in the 60s.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. This is where it started.
Right.
Yep.
Drag races.
Yeah. Now we're anti-woke.
Drag race story hour. Last one. Would you rather have U.S. urged to end Latin American aid or House group planning Black Muslim inquiry?
Oh, geez. I mean, the choices, they're also appealing. You choose. Okay, the Black Muslim thing. Yeah, Muslims.
Yeah, I knew you'd say that.
Fuck you. What does that mean?
The House Un-American Activities Committee may open a nationwide investigation of the Black Muslims next year to determine whether they are subversive, committee officials declared Thursday. Although committee members, including Chairman Walter, D. Pennsylvania, and Representative Doyle, D. California, declined to say where the probes might be conducted, other congressional sources indicated that Los Angeles would probably be a focal point. Asked specifically if the House group is considering hearings in Los Angeles where the Muslims are especially strong, Doyle replied, "All I can say now is that the investigation, if we have it, will be very thorough." He did concede, however, that he is quite concerned about recent racial incidents involving the Negro extremist group in Southern California and said he had been in touch with many constituents regarding the problem. Walter, meanwhile, revealed the committee is already embarked on a preliminary investigation of the group, which preaches a doctrine of black supremacy. It is also known as the Nation of Islam.
Sick. I mean, yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, that's, fuck, man, you know what I mean?
Yeah. We are looking into whether this is a subversive organization dedicated to overthrowing forcibly or with violence the constitutional form of government, the California lawmaker said.
It's really funny, the whole, like, we're going to look into it thing. And meanwhile, the FBI is there going, like, look into it, don't look into it, whatever. We're just going to kill some guys. Yeah. You know, we got to kill Malcolm X real quick.
Yeah.
Keep looking into it, whatever.
You're not supposed to reveal that we're doing all this illegal surveillance stuff. Right. Jay Edgar's got this covered.
Yeah, don't worry about this. Yeah. I mean, hearings or whatever, but we already got a guy we're going to kill.
Yeah, we got a guy that's going to tell us how to kill this guy, too.
Yeah. We're actually going to use the Nation of Islam to kill the guy. It's a whole thing. They're going to make a movie about it. It's crazy.
Did you know that George's glasses on Seinfeld were actually from the prop room of Malcolm X? They were actually Malcolm X glasses. Like, it was a Malcolm X prop.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude. The bass Costanza.
Yeah.
I love a bass Costanza.
Walter told the House that, quote, if it is determined that the committee has such authority, we may conduct a very extensive investigation. His comment was in response to a resolution by Representative Rivers, D. South Carolina, requesting such an investigation. In an angry speech on the House floor, Rivers condemned the Black Muslims as a group, quote, dedicated not to God, but to murder, naked violence, hatred, and mugging.
Oh, naked violence.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. That's sick. Yeah. So that's what was happening at the time that this episode came out. It is, well, not came out, but it was set in. It's very good context, and we got that. It's a cultural context we've all craved. Okay. So before we start, I got a small Draper D story. It sucks. It's based on a song that was written by someone who I assume is related to Vince. Here we go.
Pete Campbell, whiter than all whites. His dad died on a flight today. And Don Draper, the drink maker, has to fire Mohawk to pitch to AA.
It's American Airlines. All right. Well, so there's more, and I did have to speed it up a little bit, and it sounds worse sped up. So I'm gonna make it sound better.
I didn't know that you played piano like that. That's beautiful.
Yeah, that was me playing piano, as everyone knows.
I knew that you had magic fingers, but not.
I do.
Not that you were tickling the ivories.
I can tickle the ivories, and I can make you squirt. So today a lot of things happen in this episode. There's a big plane crash episode. Flight one is a flight New York to Miami or some shit. The flight crashes in Jamaica Bay, and everyone is wondering, hey, what kind of good joke can I make about it? And then we find out Pete Campbell's dad was on it, and other things happen. It's a very much an episode about how you sell certain parts of your soul in order to succeed at work. Pete does that, and so does Peggy a little bit. But Vince, what did you think of this episode?
I'm so glad you asked, Matt. Well, as we've noted, you know, season one of Mad Men, it's about Don fighting for his place in the system. He's he's clawing his way up. Season two, he has reach this place where he's comfortable in the system, but now he's sort of starting to see the problems with this system.
Yeah.
I really wish they would have called this episode the presentation business, because that is what it's all about. That is the line that Peggy has. And it's basically about that living your life is sort of incompatible with the demands of capitalism, which is that you are a working machine. Like you are a productivity machine, and you are not supposed to have things like fathers and like places to go after work. You know, Pete's dad dies on the plane, and then it leads into sort of this other aspect of capitalism, which is sort of like the shock doctrine premise is that like any sort of tragedy instantly becomes an opportunity. And so we see that with Duck Phillips, as the thing that happens, him trying to be good at his job is sort of incompatible with his humanity, because he doesn't want to take any time to mourn or help Pete with any of his life stuff. He's immediately on to like, how can we exploit this for personal gain?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Sean, general thoughts on this episode?
I watched this show for the first time a couple of years. I mean, sorry, I watched this whole show years ago. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed, it was funnier than I remembered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it is like a real like dark deadpan. People talk about how Jon Hamm like was secretly good at comedy. He's good at comedy on this show.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. There's no secret to it. He is actually very funny on this show.
Yeah, and it's just I don't know. People don't understand that.
Well, it's because he's not making faces, or at least the faces he's making are consistent with the faces that the character would make. Whereas, like, you know, he would go on 30 Rock and be like, wow, he can be funny. And it's like, he's literally always been funny. It's fucking
insane. I sent
you
the face that he makes, which I think of as the Don Draper face, where it's just like a sort of like, it's like a frown, but it's also saying fuck off in his head.
Oh, yeah. I love that face.
It's the ultimate. Yeah, I do too.
It's a great film. Yeah, and also what struck me about this episode too is I don't think I realized the first time I watched the show that Sterling Cooper kind of sucks relative to other agencies.
Yeah.
Like they're very much like there's a lot of like kind of Sopranos analog to this. I mean,
sure.
Matthew Weiner, obviously, but like this is like the 2-bit crew of Manhattan advertising, basically.
Right. They're and like they're the New Jersey family in a way. There's just kind of like this other pygmy thing, as Phil Leotardo called it.
And this episode has so much striving from everybody and then revealing the fakeness behind it. Like Sterling Cooper was just blowing smoke up for Mohawk Airlines. Pete's family doesn't actually have any money, even though he's just sort of like assumed to be in this world. Paul is a big fraud.
Paul is
Joan's a fraud too.
So it's like
everybody's sort of like shitty details that they're hiding are all coming out.
It's the presentation business, and it's very telling that like the first thing that happens when Pete's father dies is like his main question is like, okay, well, what am I supposed to look like?
Right.
Like, what image am I supposed to present when this happens?
Totally. Because
I know the image that I'm supposed to present, like as a business guy in a suit and an account manager. Yeah. I know what that looks like, but what does it look like when a guy's dad dies in a plane crash? How do I do that? And then
I love that he goes to Dawn for that too. Know how to pretend to be a person.
Exactly. So,
Like, it's not like they're close.
You know? Not at all. In fact, they are kind of like, you know,
adversarial.
adversarial.
I mean, two episodes. I mean, I guess it's like been a year since the previous season, but
he did try to ruin his life.
And then the other like aspect of that is he goes home, he finds out his dad has been, you know, misrepresenting himself. Like, oh, did he have a mistress? Was he doing something human? No, he was just trying to look like someone who was successful at business, which is the whole point. And then, like, one of my favorite lines in this episode is Dot, Pete's mom. She says, "He called you two salt and pepper." And then his brother just takes a big swig of his scotch because it's like, even his nicknames for his kids were very, like, skin deep, where it's like, yeah, I called him salt and pepper because one of them had dark hair and the other one had light hair. Good job, fucking loser.
They also had this look of them like, no, he really didn't. Like maybe he said that when we were babies, but he has not said a kind word to us in 30 years. It is.
Do you remember Pete's brother's name?
No, I don't remember it.
Sorry to interrupt again, but like Pete's sister-in-law, like she is. Bud. I think it's Bud. She's saying words. She's saying like nice words. Oh, my dad always admired him. And then Trudy is like, oh, what a nice thought. And she says, yeah, I like to present a bouquet of thoughts. It's like she is critiquing her own. She is praising her own presentation of grief, which is amazing.
Yes. Yeah, it is very much.
That was my favorite line of the episode, by the way.
Well, my favorite moment of the episode happens during that scene, and it's when Dot, Pete's mom, sees a porcelain elephant for the first time. And it's just like, what is that? And then her reaction to it is, Trudy, you can keep that. Can you get that away from me?
There's a few inexplicable elements of this episode, and like why she reacted to the porcelain elephant is one of those ones where I'm like, I have no idea
what it signifies to her personally, but in the scene, what it signifies to me is kind of like, you know, what you're getting here, which is just like, this is a person who, like, this family has no money and has pretended to have money this entire time. That porcelain elephant was like part of the pretense, like, just like, oh, of course I'm rich, check out the elephant. And you know, there's a, like a little bit of like the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
It being like, we have no money, you know, art stuff. No big deal.
Yeah. I didn't know if it was that or if she's like, ooh, elephant seems a little too exotic.
Yeah. It could be that too. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It could be that too.
It actually had color in it. And they're like, yeah, we don't care for
color. I like it. Just in that moment, she's just like, well, it wouldn't be a celebration of my husband's life without a little racism for no reason. Speaking of racism for no reason, I want to start off talking about the Joan Paul, and Paul stuff. It is
Paul Kinsey's wonderful dinner party.
Ooh. Oh, it's so great. So we start off this episode with the party, and like Pete and Trudy are showing up to this party, and I love that every woman in this scene is like like mostly worried about their car because he lives in like Newark.
He lives in Montclair, New Jersey.
Montclair, yes. Where Dr. Melfi's office is.
Yes.
Actually, on The Sopranos.
Yes.
I've actually been to Montclair. One of my first weekends in New York, I helped a friend move into a dorm in Montclair.
Oh, wow. Well, look at that.
Montclair State. And I don't remember anything about it other than it being like a sort of charmless suburb.
It's weird because I think it's like basically the same distance from where Dawn lives.
I think it's closer.
But the difference, it's like 10 miles from Manhattan.
Well, that's the whole New York thing. It's
but
like...
But the big difference is that Dawn can take a train to Grand Central Station and basically be at work.
Yes.
Whereas Paul has to go to the Port Authority bus terminal, which even in the 60s is not the nicest spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like as soon as you it's like it all depends on what direction you go in. And if you're going south, everyone's like, ew. If you're going
he's going due west. He's going across the state line to New Jersey. You can go across the state line to Connecticut, but once you go across the state line to New Jersey, you're officially trash.
It's crazy. Like sometimes I just look at a map and I'm like, what? You guys are crazy.
look at all them bays. That's weird.
What is Connecticut even? Yeah. Do you guys ever think about that? What is it?
Well, I did some. The big difference, though, is particularly Montclair has like an African American community. It's like consistently been like 30% African American.
Right.
Decades,
basically. And it's very much like implied in this entire scene with the fact that, like, you know, I mean, I think Trudy even says, like, I have nothing against those people. I just I'm worried about the car or something along those lines.
I mean, but from Manhattan, you almost
not
have
at all dangerous. It's like very much a bedroom community, even at that point.
They get there. Harry's wife is also worried about crime, and
worried about Harry being a degenerate,
he's almost not even in this episode, but I like that they made sure to remind you that Harry Crane is the most loathsome character on Mad Men.
Yeah, you know what's interesting too, that this is the first time you actually see his wife, and for the first time I was like, oh, I get it. Like, this guy has the hottest wife of all of the guys. Like, I feel like that is a beautiful, beautiful wife, and now I understand why he's like such a wife guy and such like a cuck about it. He's like calling like, I cheated on you, like that. And before you even know it's Paul's place, like they don't say it, and then you're like, you know, it's Paul's place. Yeah, you just know it. And he shows up and he's wearing this fucking fruity necktie thing. I don't know what that is called.
So the beard is new for season 2, right?
I think so.
He's clean shaven in the first season.
I don't know. You might be right about that. But the beard, I mean, it fits so well.
Like an ascot or a version of an ascot.
I don't know what it is, but it's like, man, this guy is a lot. Kenny is harassing women. Sal is watching.
Sal also has a beard.
Yes, but hey. Then Joan is talking to him, and they have this like little this little moment where I was just like, God damn, Paul sucks. And it's when he forces Joan to basically ask what some reference he says is.
He says, I'm drinking the Rhone, blah, blah, blah. And her reaction is...
Fine.
Pause. Fine. What is it?
Yeah, I have it.
Yeah, he also references this landscape painter.
Yeah.
It's like, you know this guy?
Yes, that's his favorite
the pride
thing.
Of Montclair,
New Jersey. Why did you get the nice glass?
Because I have the Rhone Gallagher.
Fine, what is it?
A ship that went down in 1871.
It's so fucking funny. Joan just get like she's playing with the idea of not following up, and then she's just like, okay, I am just interested enough, and it's your party, I'm gonna let you tell me some bullshit. And then
of course he's just not sharing it with anyone either.
Right, of course. He's you know, that's who he is. And he eventually introduces Joan to his new girlfriend. He's got a black girlfriend, and Joan is just kind of immediately racist to her, which like Joan is racist.
She starts out just doming her by making it a point to say, when I was with Paul.
Right. Yes.
So she's saying, not only first she starts out like, you think it's just going to be like her making it a point to say that she fucked Paul before his new girlfriend, and then she gets like overtly
I have that scene as well.
She's like, you've never shopped at a supermarket before.
I have that scene. Here it is.
Sheila's an assistant manager
at the food fair in South Orange.
She's saving for school.
I don't think we have a food fair in Manhattan. Is it a big market with a parking lot?
It is.
Well, one day you'll drive in a station wagon and be a customer.
Oh, I grew up out here. I've already been a customer.
Well, it's good to see you and Paul together. I have to say, when Paul and I were together, the last thing I would have taken him for was open-minded.
I love your purse.
So just like completely out of pocket for no reason. And it's funny because as the, you know, show goes on, eventually we get to kind of Joan's reasoning around it. And she's also not wrong, but only in Paul's direction.
Like, yes.
Yeah.
She's essentially like, she is racist, but she's also not wrong about why Paul sucks. And,
she's doing a Trump thing where it's like, oh man, that guy sucks. And then you watch him be mean to Jeb Bush and you're like, yeah, he got a point.
Yeah, he's got a point there. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're both redheads. There's something about these redheads, man. It's crazy watching like Paul's reaction, because so Paul spends the rest of this episode avoiding Joan, or like giving her like the cold shoulder, and she apparently doesn't notice for a few days.
Yeah, it takes 3 days.
And finally he explains why he's mad, and she actually just lets lets him off the hook. He doesn't even have to get into it before she's like, oh, I'm gonna do more racist shit right at you. And it's it's pretty bad. I'm gonna play that as well.
Oh my god, I knew you were a lot of things.
I'm not a phony.
You're so proud.
It's so obvious why you're seeing her. A supermarket checkout girl. Conversation must be stimulating. Lettuce costs a nickel.
What a relief. You're just jealous.
Because you're the one who got away. You out there in your poor little rich boy apartment in Newark or wherever. Walking around with your pipe and your beard. Falling in love with that girl just to show how interesting you are. Go ahead. What part is wrong?
I mean,
she nailed him. He's also racist.
I'd have hit her. I'd have just hit her. Like, you bitch.
I mean, I think Paul is really interesting because like he is another manifestation of the presentation game, which is that like if you drill down into anything that Paul ever suggests, he's terrible at his job.
Yes.
Like, the only way that he is an artist is in the way that he's crafted a persona, because he actually like sucks at writing and is not funny. Like his whole writing is like doing puns and making jokes. And you see after the plane crashes in this, like, he makes the worst joke of the bunch by far, where it's like, that isn't even a good tag.
What was his joke? I don't remember.
Pioneering
his...
vertical flight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that sucks.
Freddy's joke is pretty good. I think he says, what does he say, like?
He says, Idlewild to Rockaway in 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then
Paul said, and then Pete's
joke is
stained plaid.
Yeah.
Too much setup.
Yeah,
but that was a decent. But you got what he was going for there.
Like,
yeah,
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I fully get that joke.
This is a guy who could write for Boys Life magazine.
Yeah, exactly.
He did some imagery there. Paul couldn't even do that. He just did like, oh, I'm clever because, you know,
because I use big words.
Vertical flights, like, yeah, the plane does go vertically.
Yeah, it actually does. Yeah. But
Orson Welles beard.
Wait, can you explain the plaid joke? Is it because golfers wear plaid?
Because
that's the whole thing, yeah.
Well, it's that plus like the trope of a tragedy happens and it's staining the bay red, or it's staining the beaches on Omaha Beach turned red with the blood of the fucking, you know, whatever. Like, that's like an old storytelling sort of trope. Isn't it?
Okay. Yeah. You don't really see, do you still see plaid? Vince, you're a golfer.
No, I don't think that after the 70s, that was really like ever a thing.
And was the plaid like a throwback to like guys in kilts?
I guess. I'm not sure. Like, yeah. You saw a lot of plaid pants on golfers in the 70s, but like everybody was wearing plaid in the 70s. Basketball coaches were wearing plaid suits in the 70s. Yeah. So I don't know.
Rules. I want
to get to the point where Payne Stewart
back.
Was the only guy who wore plaid.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, tour. The golf is
also
so
died
boring.
In a plane crash.
Wait,
yeah,
who
did?
Did
die in a Payne Stewart.
Oh, yeah, him.
Golf is so boring and homogenous that if anybody dresses different at all, it becomes like a trademark. Like, Payne Stewart dressed like the biggest dipshit in the world, but like, you're like, well, at least he looked like different a little bit. And people were like, look at that guy. He's got knickers on. Wow.
His name was Payne?
Payne, yeah. Yeah.
P-A-I-N?
P-A-Y.
Oh, that's even cooler.
Like Damon Wayans is military character.
Like Max Payne with the bullet time.
Mm-hmm.
That's sick.
That is that's an old school Southern boy name right there.
Dude, that or like Illyn Payne. You guys remember Illyn Payne from Game of Thrones?
I feel like he and Payne Stewart and Davis Love the Third.
Davis
like
Love the Third's a good name too.
Killed like a guy.
Yeah, that's two frat guys
car,
who murdered a woman.
yeah, yes, those are guys who did like a different Chappaquiddick. Just at a different lake. Oh shit! It's producer Brent.
Hello. I know this was 45 minutes ago, but were you talking about Tori Malatia?
Who was?
Oh,
is that
on
the
This American
Ira Glass
Life.
Bit that he does at This American Life? He's always talking about Tori Malatia, not Matt Lieb.
Oh shit! Well, that's what I meant.
A few.
That's what I meant. My bad. Shout out to Tori Malatia. Well, anyways, what do you want?
Also, ads. I think we should probably do ads.
You wanted to do a commercial?
Yeah, some ads would be good.
Oh, I love ads. Well, let's do that. Hey, everybody, if you're interested in buying stuff, it's time for you to consider what to buy with your money. So listen to these advertisements, and we'll be right back.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to fling your favorite fishing rod around. And here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance covers your boat and your belongings. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to high-five someone. But not while you're holding your fishing rod. That's a prized possession. So hold on tight with both hands and keep it covered through boat insurance. Get more with GEICO.
And we're back. It's Mad Men. It's Mad Yourself a Man. We hope you enjoyed those madvertisements. And we're here with Sean Keen of Roundball Rock. What's up, Sean?
Hey, how's it going, guys?
The same.
Oh, how are you?
It's just madding it up. I'm mad. I'm mad about this podcast.
I'm mad
about men.
Mad
yourself a you.
Mad.
This episode, Paul dies in a plane crash. And Jamie has to rebuild her life. with her new spouse, Cousin Ira.
I love doing a Mad About You podcast called Mad Yourself a You.
Oh, I will have to kill myself if we watch that show, because even when that show was out, I hated that show.
You should just rewatch the reboot.
They made a reboot?
Yeah, their kid's going to college in the first episode or something.
Why don't they just have... Well, I guess because they have the same actors.
I'm pretty sure
Paul Reiser wrote the theme song. Wrote the theme song too.
Well, I wrote the theme song to this part. Yeah. Woke up this morning, mad yourself for you.
I love you like I do. Tell me who.
That was the only good part of that show. I always joked that that Kenny Banya on Seinfeld was just Larry David's cruel parody of Jerry Seinfeld.
Yes,
but that's the joke version. I think the actual version is that Paul Reiser is the Kenny Banya.
Oh, shit.
Jerry Seinfeld's. Because it's like he takes all of Jerry's like observational humor and like turns it into sort of just
happy-go-lucky schlock. Yeah.
It turns it into like shitty neuroticism where you're like, okay, shut the fuck up. I don't care what you think about toothpaste.
It is crazy that like Paul Reiser makes Jerry Seinfeld feel edgy.
Yes.
It is kind of wild. Although, to be fair, I don't think Paul Reiser ever dated a 17-year-old when he was 38.
Yeah.
1738. Sorry, that was... doesn't matter. What's his name? Freddie Wop? Something Wop.
Fetty.
Fetty Wop. Jesus.
Freddie. I think his real name was Freddie, but yeah, that's how it got.
What's Wop with me? Speaking of Wop, no, got nothing for that. We're talking about Mad Men, so let's get into... the last thing I'll say about Joan, they post her birthday on the... cork board in Peggy's office, and it turns out she's in her 30s.
Yeah, she's 31, I believe.
Yeah, she's 30. Yeah.
Ancient.
Yeah, and I was just like, did people think she was younger than that? Because that's kind
of... Right, yeah. Was she constantly saying her age out loud? Like, what was the implication there?
Well, so both of you guys implied that... that Joan was also kind of all presentation. Were you speaking of this scene in particular, or what were you guys talking about when you were talking about?
That's what I was talking about.
Okay,
is that like revealing her age somehow tears down the facade?
Yeah, the facade, yeah.
It undercuts her presentation of youthful gal about town, and when it's like it turns her into an old maid rather than fun single gal.
She's a haggard, barren old hag at 31 years old.
Her eggs are rotting on the vine.
Rotting eggs.
Is that how eggs work?
Christina Hendricks is also like maybe 32.
at this point for sure and she's just so hot, so I don't really care, mama. So we got to get into the plane crash. It's the majority of this episode. Everyone gets to the office, or at least Don and Roger get to the office, and everyone's listening to the radio, and it's because a plane has crashed. It's flight one. Everyone's making jokes. And then Pete gets a phone call, and he finds out, oh no, his papa was on the plane. And he has... And his reaction to it is fucking great. Like, I truly love the scene where he is revealing this to Dawn, and we covered this, but like the just like on acting chops alone, I was like really impressed with his doing a shock thing. Like, he's clearly like in shock about this information, and it's also incredibly funny that he's still like a little Lord Fauntleroy about it. Like, he's like, what does one do when Papa dies in a fiery crash? And it's a great scene, so I want to play that.
What?
My father, he was on the plane.
Oh God, I'm sorry to hear that.
What does one do? Make arrangements, I guess. What am I supposed to do?
What people do. Go home.
I don't even think I know how old he was. Someone's going to ask that. You know what? I don't think I'm going to tell anyone. Am I going to cry?
Go home and be with your family.
Why?
Because that's what people do.
Is that what you would do?
Yes.
Everything's exactly the same.
Just his entire process in that scene is so funny to watch, where he's like, he's trying to figure out how he feels about it and what, like, he needs to know how he feels about it so that he can know what mask to put on. And so that it, you know, so he's like asking, like, all right, what would a human being who loves his father do? And when Don tells him, go home, he's like, okay, what I mean is, what would a successful, ambitious human being do to still get ahead in this world, but also not seem like a total monster?
How do I best leverage this?
Yeah. How do I leverage this so that everyone's happy and I somehow advance, but I also don't advance too much because that would be gauche. And it's just wonderful seeing that scene. Whereas Don is like, you know, for all his faults, Don is like, I mean, to say, I don't, whether or not he's a sociopath, like, all of these guys have this, like, sociopathic quality to them, but I'm starting more and more to, like, kind of put that term away when it comes to describing characters on the show, because I'm realizing it's like, rather than pathologizing this as, like, some, like, you know, symptom of whatever childhood stuff and whatnot, it's like everyone has the ability to have this particular pathology of being like a soulless striver if they are working within this capitalistic system. Like, everyone has the ability to do this. You don't have to be born bad, you know, or like made bad through abuse or whatever. It's just like, you know, Peggy is also doing the same thing where she's like literally giving up a baby, you know, and pretending that her baby is not her baby. It's like living with her family in order
to... it's ambiguous whether that is her baby, but we can get to that later.
Wait, what's ambiguous?
I think because it's ambiguous that it's her baby.
Yeah, she gave her baby up for adoption in the last season. Like, it was very clearly like structured so that like she didn't want to look at her baby. She was giving it up, and then in this, it was like unclear whether that was her baby or her sister's babies that reminded her of her baby.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's her baby. I mean,
no,
that...
I think it's her sister's baby.
Is it?
I'm pretty. I mean,
Matthew Weiner has been asked that, and he says he left it deliberately ambiguous.
Yeah.
Oh.
I think it's just from the context of the. I just remember from the watching the show before. I don't know what information we have at this point in like the episodes that have been shown, but I think she almost definitely gave the baby up for adoption.
Yeah. Okay. And then there's the other thing about her being psychologically unfit or whatever. I don't know. It's unclear. It's ambiguous.
I think it is her baby. Supposed to be ambiguous at this point, though.
Yes.
Sure. Sure. Well, okay. My point still stands, which is just like, I wouldn't call Peggy someone who is like a sociopathic person, you know, necessarily. But they all possess the ability to act sociopathically.
Yes. I mean, there's a read on Pete where he doesn't know how to act, partly because he didn't like his father, and his father, like, he and his father didn't get along. So he doesn't know how sad he's supposed to. He doesn't know how sad he's supposed to present, partly because he's not that sad. He's not as sad as he should be because he and his dad didn't get along. But it's also, you know, like you say, it's a work thing. And like the main thing that separates like Pete and Don is guile. And Pete does not have guile. And Don knows like how he's supposed to act like a human, even if it's not, even if he's not 100% believing it. And I think Duck Phillips is like also another version of Don who also lacks guile, because like he is, you know, he's trying to turn this instantly into a, like, there's a lack of decorum with which he, like, instantly pursues profit. And it's also, that's also, like, partly Don realizing, like, why this, like, system is shitty. And part of that is, like, pursuing short-term profits at the expense, or pursuing, like, a stable business at the, as you chase, like, short-term profits, like, instead of just being able to have a stable business where you have a good client that pays you whatever it is, $1 million a year,
$1 million a year,
they want to dump that for the promise of, you know, $7 million a year, which is sort of like what capitalism has turned into, where you eschew, like, stable profits in order to sell this this idea of growth, which, like, sort of matters more to the market.
Right. It does
sort of, and that's like Steve's, or sorry, that's like Pete's dad too, which is that he, like, when you scratch the surface of any, like, successful entity, like, almost always there's like a ton of debt underpinning it. And, like, that's like a consistent theme. Like,
yeah.
I mean, isn't that kind of, doesn't Pete pretty much have his job because of his father being considered a rich guy too?
Yes.
That's why he has the job, you know, first and foremost.
I mean, they're basically all rich, I think.
Yeah.
Not Don, but, like, Paul's family's rich, Ken's family's rich.
Yeah, for the most part, everyone who's there comes from, you know, like, a upper middle class to, like, wealthy blue blooded family. Like, there's not too many, like, trash guys. Like, probably Harry Crane might be a trash guy, but it's like, if you're a trash guy, then your wife is probably worth something. And, like, Pete, you know, and Trudy's relationship is also based on this kind of, like, you know, families marrying into each other's wealth.
Classic old money, new money.
Exactly.
Collab.
Yeah, classic collab.
The implication with the Pete's mom has, like, a Dutch last name, I think, when they talk
about
the
church. Yes.
And I think that heavily implies, like, old money.
Right.
Yeah, no, they have a famous name.
A foundation in the slave trade.
They have a 100%.
Yeah.
They have a famous name.
They
have a famous name and they don't have money, and so they have to marry someone who has money but not a famous name.
Yeah. Exactly.
Money, new money, baby.
Our powers combined, we can get into any country club. So Don's reaction to Duck is interesting because I agree with you. Like, I think Don is someone who still does kind of consider himself like an artist doing art. He just is like, he kind of thinks he does the only good art. Like, he's like, everyone else's art is like self-indulgent, whereas mine pays the bills and also influences people.
Well, it feels like the equivalent of Joan ripping on Paul.
Right.
His Duck saying, oh, they're going to see your Mohawk ads. And
right. Yes. Yeah.
That's
also
how I used to feel about stand-up comedy, too, where I'm like, well, people just see me on this show and then.
they'll see me and then
they'll book me at the clubs.
Yeah. give that guy $10 million.
At Berkeley.
But Don is also just like, I think he's making ultimately, like, the better business decision. But,
right. Yeah,
it's more about it's like Duck's doing the thing where it's about the perception of growth and not actual money, which he may be right about. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. But also Don is, I think the difference or what separates the two is, like, because Duck is just a straight business guy, you know, he's just like head of accounts or whatever. He's looking at this completely from a, like, I don't care about the fact that, you know, we'll lose Mohawk. Isn't it so much more fun to chase the exciting new big thing, you know? And Don's like, no, what's exciting to me is taking Mohawk and turning it into American Airlines. Like, he's more excited about the work, the art that goes into doing that. And he is kind of disgusted by Duck. I also think it is a little bit just because he thinks Duck is another tactless ghoul.
Yes, that's what it is. Yeah, he thinks Duck is a guileless
Yeah.
Like a gauche, guileless bitch.
Yeah.
Which he is. I hate Duck.
Yeah, Duck is
bad.
Beat
his ass this whole episode.
Duck, Duck, Goose, bitch. And then you hit him on the head. Don is mad about it, and he has to go, and in order to just get a bite at the apple, he has to fire the Mohawk, essentially, as a client. And there's a little scene in which he does that at the end, and basically he has to put on his coldest face, even though it like really wasn't his fault and he really didn't want to do it. But he's like a soldier, and he's like, well, I'm not going to say, no, it wasn't me.
He did say that.
Well, he didn't quite say that. He
said, not my decision.
Yeah, but that's what you would say to anybody. I'm putting myself in his position, and I'd be like crying. I'm so sorry. I really wanted to. I like keep saying that over and over. Like I would be whining at him, just so he would have to comfort me. But instead,
yeah, you can't yell at me if I'm already crying.
Yeah, you can't yell at me. I'm already crying. But instead, he's putting on his fucking poker face, and the guy's like, "This is Pearl Harbor. You fooled me," and walks away.
Great.
And, yeah. Great. And then,
this is just you doing advertising to me. I get it.
Yeah, yeah, I see what you did. In terms of like Dawn's like home life in this, there's a small Betty and the family arc in which they have to entertain Carlton and Francine, the neighbors mm-hmm. next door. Francine, you'll remember from previous episodes, found out that Carlton was cheating on him, kept an apartment in the
cheating on her.
Mm-hmm. Cheating on her, yeah. So they're still together. They're hanging out, and
so if we're gonna do favorite, least favorite,
yeah,
least favorite part of this episode for me,
okay,
Carlton's fat suit. I did not need. I mean, if you're gonna want him to be fat,
you're
hire
so,
a fat guy to play him. Why do we need to hire a skinny guy?
You're so good at. I can't tell if you're good at being able to tell this shit, or I am just completely blind.
Really?
Because
as soon as he came on screen, I'm like, what is wrong with this guy's face? That is not his real face.
I didn't. His
neck did look weird, but I hadn't. Yeah, I
didn't place that at all.
Like
yeah, same.
Before. That's
same.
The.
I don't remember what he looked like before. All I saw was a fat suit, and I was like, that's weird. Something's off.
I'm embarrassed to say I didn't notice. I thought the scenes itself were. The only thing that I found kind of humorous was. One was Carlton trying to like egg Dawn into a conversation about how high school girls were hot, and Dawn is just like, I'm not interested in doing this.
It's also funny because Dawn's like, I don't want to talk about having sex with women. I just do it.
Right.
Like,
exactly.
It's Dawn's guile being like, why can't everyone be better at the pretense like I am?
Yeah, why is everyone like so bad at this?
Yeah, he's kind of prudish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In like a public way, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, because...
Show a little decorum is like what he's always saying like in his mind, I think.
Yeah.
And this is also... This scene is sort of Mad Men in a microcosm where like you're simultaneously thinking, man... Wouldn't it be cool to live back when we were like a proper country where you had your friends over for bridge and you had your like 7-year-old daughter making you Tom Collins's? Like that seems like it fucking rules. And then at the same time, you're like, oh, but it didn't because you had to talk to some fat alcoholic about how he wants to fuck a teenager.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Everyone is unhappy. But everyone just looks back and goes, oh, remember those days? Those were great on paper.
I will say, as someone who recently got married,
congratulations.
No,
thank you.
He didn't say it, but I thought
my dating life would basically end, but now I'm constantly going on like blind dates with other men.
Welcome
to
hell,
dog.
Our relation
is that they're married to someone who went to college with my wife.
Oh yeah,
and that's what we have in common.
Oh, that's
sometimes we're left alone for a long time.
That's the best it's gonna get. If you guys ever have kids,
then you're gonna
have to hang out with other parents whose kid goes to the same music class.
Yeah,
and you're gonna be like, and they're gonna be like, so comedy, huh? Do a joke. And it's like, oh, here's a joke. Look in the mirror. I always say that one.
In our neighborhood so far, where we've lived for like 2 years, the people that we will hang out with socially is like dog based.
Oh, yeah.
That's
yeah.
a filter. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Where you get to look at the dog
and it's a soft intro. And then you can like evaluate like.
Yeah.
Like our neighborhood friends tend to have dogs, but that was only the intro. But it's not like it's not like Pinot Noir.
It's no, it's not.
And there's events, and
you can
just give the head nod and keep on walking. We gotta go. Oh, she's feisty today.
It gets so much worse.
Do is you start complaining about the coaches, and you talk about
game. Yeah, I mean that's good. That's good. I mean that's also maybe like part of the reason for fantasy sports is just for maybe. Married men in these situations.
To make better friends. No, what I do, my strategy has literally been to be like, I host a anti-Israel podcast. And then I wait for the conversation to die. And I go, all right, now I'm free to go on my phone and play phone games. I hate it here. So the other thing I like in this, you know, home scene where they're all playing bridge was Betty is complaining about their son because he traced a picture, and I have that that audio as well.
Because he brought it home, and I noticed the exact same image of Washington on the cover of one of his books. He had traced it.
What happened?
I mean, the point is, it was dishonest.
My whole art department is run on tracing paper. Why reinvent the wheel?
And I don't care about tracing. What about all that praise he accepted for something he didn't do?
Well, the book says to start fibbing at this age. I want to see if they can make it come true.
I don't need a book to know what little boys do.
I love everything about this, because she's like, well, first you're tracing, and the next thing you know, you're fucking some secretary. It's just so deep into the, like, this is the beginning of men lying. And, you kind of got to hand it to her. Like, she's not wrong.
I like that Carlton sort of poked holes in her story, and he's like, so he took a book from home to trace at school? And she's like, I don't know. The point is...
Yeah,
he was lying, and soon he's gonna be just doing it. So
he's gonna finger fuck every little girl he sees because he's disgusting. Even though he's got a mama at home to finger fuck, and you're just like, whoa, hey, what's going on? What's going on, Betty? Anyways, the relationship between Betty and her son is gonna continue to grow as the season grows. But I do love what's coming with the little boy.
And Dawn's actually nice to him.
Yeah, Dawn is nice. Dawn is like
he's a bad father, but he's not an abusive father.
Exactly.
Most of the time.
Exactly.
He's tastefully detached.
Yeah.
Right. His like, he's not going to be physically violent, and he's not going to be, at least at this point, he's not going to shame the child. He mostly is just watching Betty be overly critical, and it's just like, okay, I think my role here is to be like, don't worry, sometimes your mother's a little cuckoo. Yeah.
Protect him from the hen pecking.
Yes, exactly. And you know, to contrast that, you know, you've got Peggy, who is forced to say goodnight to someone who could possibly be her little bastard, Pete. I'm not sure. When I looked at that boy, I was like, he kind of looks like Pete. But then again, Pete does look like every baby. And here's my theory. Not only do I believe, yes, that is Peggy's baby, I believe those other kids are also Peggy's.
Yeah, she's constantly. So here's my question about Peggy.
Mm.
Why is she only horny for Pete? She's got all these other guys there trying to get into those drawers and
that's true.
Smack it around, but she's like, nope.
Smack it around.
Yeah.
I want a guy who has a fantasy about killing an animal in a log cabin.
Yeah.
I want to get run through, but only by a married sociopath.
Yeah.
It's so weird that Pete somehow represents masculinity to her, too.
Yeah.
Even though it's sort of like maybe just his aggression or sort of like secret vehemence, because she has like no time for guys who are, I don't know, named Eugene.
Yeah,
I don't know what it is. It's like she, because Pete is so guileless that she's like sort of attracted to this, I don't know, this broken little boyness about him. Like he's sort of an, he's like the honest liar version of an incel, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's hard to tell what her type is. I mean, so far, it just does seem like her type is Pete. But also, I think we're supposed to assume now that she's like making out with random dudes and turning them down, that she's also like fucking a lot of other guys. Like,
yeah,
I think
she's not desperate for a taste anymore. She's in the room and she's more comfortable. She's like Dawn.
She's holding a candle for Pete a little bit, but I do think that she's getting around. Like she's still, you know, she's still fucking.
I mean, that's what I write about in my fan fiction for sure.
Like, Peggy be fucking slapping around that
all
lip
position.
Lip meat. What?
Where's Peggy living at this point?
She lives in her own apartment in Manhattan, I think.
Did she move out of her apartment
she
with
did.
Her roommates? Okay.
Yeah, I believe so. Well, actually, I don't know if she moved out of, but it's kind of implied. I don't know. We'll see. I'm sure we'll find out where she lives.
I mean,
you know.
We saw her bed, but it wasn't clear. Yeah.
It wasn't clear. Yeah. So... anyway, so then fucking Pete is like, you know, approached by Duck, and Duck is like, hey, I have no tact, you have no tact, what if we double team this motherfucker and lose? And
I'm severely traumatized from the war. You're severely traumatized from your father dying 15 minutes ago.
Let's see our powers combined. Let's see if we can
Let's see if we can inflict some trauma on somebody else. How about that?
So he asked Pete, you know, hey, would you like, you know, come in on this meeting? I assume he's asking him. I don't know if I would go so far as to say he's asking him. He's like, hey, you know, I know your father just died, but we might be able to use that. Or if Pete makes that decision on his own. It's kind of hard to tell, but
I think he was asking Pete that. He didn't want to come right out and say it necessarily.
Yeah. Right.
And
yeah.
then, but there's an, there's a scene in between that happens. That's
right.
Important.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he, you know, he initially like turns him down and he's like, I think that would make me uncomfortable. And he wants to go back into Dawn's office and, hey, you know, ask what would Dawn do? WWD do?
What does him
do?
And he thinks about asking Trudy for about a second.
Yeah. And then it's like, oh, no, not a woman.
Women don't know anything.
Yeah. What would she know? She'd probably, you know, she'd probably playing with that porcelain elephant like a weirdo. And goes into Dawn's office and Dawn is a bit busy. And this is what happens.
What do you want, Campbell?
I just was, I don't know.
It's not a good time.
If you want, you can leave him a note. People do that.
I love that. You can leave him a note. Okay, I scared. How?
Miss Daddy,
how would human respond to exploit daddy death for gain? Yeah, so Dawn misses a chance there to, I don't know, tell him, like, don't do that.
To become Pete's dad. That's what Pete wants.
Yeah.
Just tell me how to act, Papa.
Yeah, that's true.
But he won't,
is...
and so he has to go looking for a different Papa, who happens to be Duck Phillips, the worst man in the world.
The worst Papa.
So bad at everything.
Yeah, and so he fucking just goes to that meeting. And at that meeting, he goes, hey, American Airlines guy, my daddy dead. You killed my daddy.
It's okay if you give me money.
It's okay if you give me money. And that scene is interesting because it's incredibly awkward.
Yeah, and you're like wondering where it's going to go. Like, is this plan going to be successful, or is it going to backfire because he has made that American Airlines guy feel weird?
And I feel right.
like making a guy feel weird. I mean, sometimes you can leverage that into money, but I feel like it usually doesn't go that
it
way.
It was a really strange move, and yeah, you're kind of expecting a Don Draper-esque pitch where he's like, my father was killed, you know, on that flight. And my being here is because I just want that to, you know, I don't know how Don would do it in a way where he's like, it's
we
not.
We believe in the promise of flight.
Yeah, yeah. I believe that my father always said before he passed on one of your planes that flying shouldn't be scary. And I always believed that, and I took it to heart. So please, give me the money. Whatever. But instead, he's just like, hey, so my dad died. You want to get dessert?
The American Airlines guy is not impressed.
No, either. He's
kind of like, he's happy that he's not getting, like, confronted by a man who's
crying at
yell
him.
At him or yeah. cry or something. But also, I think it maybe makes him like Sterling Cooper less.
I can't imagine it would make him like him.
He seemed to duck at the beginning of the scene.
Right.
But after that, he was almost kind of like, they're trying to use this?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And again, C-list agency.
Yes, yeah, yeah. yeah. And everyone's tactless.
It's sort of like, yeah, it sort of makes them seem grasping and desperate.
Right. Which,
yeah, it's hard to, yeah.
Which is something Don probably would have talked him out of. Yes. Like, he would have said, you don't want to be the one to do it.
Let him find out about it from someone else.
Let him find out about it from someone else. Exactly. That way, it's like, if the effect you want is, wow, these people really do want this, and they're going to work really hard,
yeah.
so much so that he's going to swallow the pride of his fucking dad dying on the flight just to help us.
Yeah.
That you can't tell them that yourself, you fucking yeah. weirdo. Anyways, so we'll see.
Yeah, if they'll find out there were 100 people on the plane,
yeah,
and his dad's business famous, you know?
Yes, yes. His
or
dad is
in New York City.
In New York City, he's known as the guy who collects the porcelain elephants. People are like, oh shit, the son of the porcelain elephant guy died. My bad. Yeah, and then, you know, Dawn fires a guy, and then he sees like a pretty Chinese prostitute, I think. And it's like, not tonight.
She's Japanese.
She's just a cocktail.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. Japanese.
I think.
Playing, what's it called? Sukiyaki?
Wait.
Yeah.
You know what that song
that's
is?
Right.
You
that's
don't right. think she's a prostitute? She's not a prostitute?
I think she, well, I think mean, she could be. Unclear. She's a hostess.
I don't think she's actually a prostitute, though. Unless I don't know. I guess I don't know.
I think it depends on how much you pay her.
Yeah, that's true. Well, the way he says not tonight almost seems like, I'm not in the mood, but maybe I'll come back later for you.
Yes.
Which made me think it was a sex worker. Yeah, and then the episode ends. Peggy's back in the church. She's basically forced to hold a child. We don't know whose it is. And she has the same blank stare as Pete. And they both have this, like, in this episode, I would say matching stare, which is just like, ignore the deep down and focus on the future.
Yeah, I think they're trying to draw a parallel between Peggy and Pete and Rachel and Dawn. Like,
100%.
Like, oh,
yeah.
Two broken recognize broken.
Yeah, well, exactly.
I also took that not tonight to mean like, Dawn's like, hey, I'm not going to cheat on my wife this time.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He said, no. I have to think about family for a little, and I don't want to be another Carlton. Because then I'll get fat.
I'll get fat, and that's disgusting.
And that's disgusting.
Kills your presentation.
Disgusting.
Yeah, I can't pitch if I'm all fat.
Fatty fat.
All right. Favorite scene, least favorite scene, or something we didn't talk about, Sean Keane.
I did some research into Montclair, New Jersey, as well as being like a usual Sopranos location. Big Yogi Berra stuff there. Yogi Berra lived there. There's a Yogi Berra museum. And that landscape painter, what's his name? George Innes? Pretty good.
Yeah.
I looked up some of his paintings. He's like, he basically, talking about Vince's presentation stuff, he's basically a bridge between realistic painting and impressionistic painting. So there's a certain amount where it's kind of like, well, yeah, this is realistic, but we got to dress it up a little bit here. We got to put a little shine on it. Some of this is a little bit fake, but I'm still trying to not make everything completely artificial and constructed. So that was, I was interested in that. Also, okay. I liked the paintings. I guess I'm going to have to start smoking a pipe.
A little Paul Kinsey. Oh, you're already married. You're already married. So you can't date the checkout lady at the grocery store who is black.
They also threw in a little bit of Japanese racism there too.
They did.
Where the guy's like, yeah, this reminds me of Pearl Harbor because I'm about to get ambushed by those.
Yeah.
The implication is by those sneaky.
Yeah.
Sneaky, deceptive.
You guys are no worse than the Japanese. just saying.
And also, Sukiyaki, while the American song is just like about missing a lady. The actual Japanese song is written about a guy who was upset at Japan signing a treaty with the United States like 15 years after the war. And Japan kind of just being like, yeah, we're selling out and entering the market now. We are no longer our traditional country. Let's sell some stuff. But the lyrics are apparently like generic enough that people were kind of like, no, he's just talking about a lover, but he, so it's about his discomfort with Japan kind of selling out too.
Interesting.
To make money. Yeah.
Vince, did anything you missed?
Oh God, I had it in my head a second ago.
Does it matter?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it matters. No, obviously I mentioned Carlton's weird fat makeup. Another small moment I liked was it's the man upstairs and Kinsey says God.
Yeah, that was good. I like that too. Yeah, if there was anything that we missed that I liked a lot, it would probably be when fucking
great podcast.
Shut up. I couldn't find it on the thing. It is when we find out that Paul like stole a typewriter. And then like Kenny tells him that some dumb girl almost got fired because of it. And I just thought it was funny where it was like, oh, you know, that stupid idiot we work with almost got fired over that. And it's just, it's like, you're already insulting her. Anyways, if I had to give this episode a letter grade, and I absolutely do, I think I would give it a B+. Vince, what would you give it if you had to give it a letter grade?
Oh, well, I was going to give it a different grade, but I feel like your strident pitch for why it was actually good really affected me. And therefore, I'm going to give it a solid B+.
Wow. Sean Keane, what would you give this if you had to give it a letter grade?
I was wavering a little bit, but Peggy's mom made me remember being forced to go to Catholic church as a kid. Oof. And how terrible it seems like it would be to read The Agony and the Ecstasy. So for that look at Catholic realism, it gets a B+ for me.
Okay, so that is a B+ all around, B+ episode of Mad Men, and an A+ episode of Mad Yourself a Man. Sean Keane, thank you so much for coming on and talking Mad Men with us.
Thank you guys.
Where can people find you?
Well, if you're in, you can find me at Sean Keane on Twitter, at Sean Keane on Blue Sky. Roundball Rock Podcast, NBA stuff. I will be at the Sacramento Punchline with Todd Barry at the end of the last weekend in March, and then I'm going to be headlining the San Francisco Punchline on
May
14th.
Go out.
Tickets are on sale today.
Fuck
and,
yeah.
Hopefully we'll have some fun special guests.
Hell to the yeah. Everyone check that out. Sean Keane, once again, thank you so much for coming on the pod. Smoking, drinking, joking, cheating, groping, squeezing, broken 60s guy. patreon.com/rockcast. The $8 tier gets you a shout out. Vince, we got four more this week. What are the chances?
Oh, that's amazing. I love
four. What are the chances? The exact same number as last week.
Weird.
And these are great. And, you know, after this great episode we just did just now, it is time to give these people a prep school name. The first one is William Neinstedt.
Nine. William Neinstedt. We call this guy El Nueve.
Oh, okay. I like it. Neinstedt. Next is Stefan Johnson.
Big D, because he's got that big Johnson with no last
name. Oh, okay. Yeah. Stefan Johnson, get that fat old dip. Bryce Morin, M-O-R-E-N, who is a $15 patron.
We call this guy the glutton, because he's always, no matter how much you give him, he wants more.
More and more. And finally, Sandy Motorino.
Sandy Motorino? What is this? This sounds like an Italian car, right?
We call this guy Broom Broom.
Hey, I'm going to get my Motorino and go to the Pichado.
Go on. Sandy Motorino.
We call this guy or girl Hasselhoff. He's always going to the beach. He always spends more time at the beach than old David Hasselhoff.
That's why
he's got such a sandy Motorino. Always.
That's right. Hey, I got sand in my Motorino. Someone take me to a fucking mechanic. That is our shout outs. If you want to get a shout out, go to patreon.com/forrotcast and join the $8 tier or above. Patreon.com/Frogcast, frogcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, and concerns. Vince, what is the Google Voice number?
415-275-0030.
All right, everyone. Thanks again so much for listening. And until next time, I do not think about you at all. Campbell, whiter than all white. His dad died on a flight today. And Don Draper, the drink maker, has to fire Mohawk to pitch to AA. That's American Airlines. Joan Harris meets Paul Kinsey's girl, calls him a liberal phony. Pete's planning his dad. Is upset. What's with this porcelain elephant? Gives it to Trudy. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yo, what up, bitch? My name is Henry Mancini. I'm sucking on my papa's D, and I'm eating butt for free, cause I don't have money. Audrey Hepburn ass. We trying to fucking eat some breakfast at Tiffany's, I think. Whatever. Vince Mancini, sucking on my ass. My bird bat flaps madly. Where do show about madman. I make come with my hand, and I eat booty. I eat the blood. Ow, ow, my penis, penis, penis.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. My penis hurts.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service, real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.